From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Over 90% of Americans polled say they believe in God. And despite our growing multiculturalism and the separation of church and state, we live in a predominantly Christian culture. But believer or not, do we know much about what's happening in the Christian world today? This hour, we'll explore different aspects of today's Christianity, the astounding popularity of the Pentecostal church.
I think the best way to describe Pentecostalism is it's kind of every man's mysticism. It's popular mysticism.
Also this hour, marketing Christianity as cool.
Our stuff doesn't have to be so irrelevant and really kind of stupid. It can be cool. We can put slimy, limey green leather on a Bible and we're not going to go to hell.
And we'll answer the question on everyone's mind. Can you be a heavy metal rocker and a born-again Christian?
When you're wearing spandex pants, you don't really look too Christian.
The pundits keep telling us that Islam will soon overtake Christianity as the world's largest religion. According to them, Christianity is in a great decline. But author Philip Jenkins doesn't think so. His book is called The Next Christendom, The Coming of Age of Global Christianity. And he says that not only is Christianity not in decline, but it's making great strides all over the world. Jenkins told Steve Paulson why American media insists Christianity is in trouble.
I think we have a perception that Christianity is the religion of the world's haves. It's Western Christianity, almost as if that is one word. What people are missing when they say that is that Christianity is doing very, very well in the global South, in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And in fact, it's doing so well there that those are going to be the emerging centers of Christianity. In terms of the proportion of the world's population, Christianity in, say, 50 years should have about the same share of population that it had back in 1900. So Christianity will still, in 2050, say, probably be the world's largest religion. And a rough estimate suggests that there will still be about 3 Christians for every 2 Muslims worldwide.
Now, is this just a matter of demographics, that there are more people in Africa and Latin America, or those populations are growing at greater rates, and that's why the locus of Christianity, the center of Christianity, will shift in that direction?
There are a couple of different trends. One is that Christianity has done very, very well in terms of gaining converts. I always use the example of Africa. Back in 1900, Christians made up about 10% of the population of Africa. Now it's about 47%. In raw numbers, that's an increase from 10 million to 360 million over the space of a century. By any reasonable standard, I think that means that Christianity numerically is one of the most successful stories of the 20th century, though perhaps we'd never get the impression of that from standing in the West. At the same time, the centers of Christianity also have very high growth rates. So it's a combination of growth by conversion and growth by demographics. But the net effect is clear. Probably within 40 or 50 years, there will be maybe 3 billion Christians worldwide. Of those, maybe 1 in 5, 1 in 6 will be a non-Latino white. We're seeing a process that you might describe as the browning of Christianity. Put another way, Christianity is returning to its roots. It's what it was virtually 2,000 years ago, a religion based in sections of Asia and Africa.
Well, this is so interesting because this is not at all the story that we tend to hear in North America. I mean, we hear about how the churches are in trouble, that people are not going anymore. We've, of course, been hearing about the scandals in the Catholic Church, and you'd get the sense that Christianity is on the decline. And maybe that's true in North America and Europe, but you're saying that's certainly not true in other parts of the world.
America has a pretty secular-minded political and cultural establishment, and they tend to see what they want to see. I mean, that's a very common thing. We all do it. You know the old phrase, if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it with my own eyes. And this is all the more so because the kind of Christianity which is growing in the global South is a Christianity that they have very little sympathy or understanding for. It tends to be much more based on tradition, authority, It's not a word I like, but it's often more fundamentalist. It's more Pentecostal. And if you don't feel at home with that kind of religion, you tend not to see it. But I'm afraid the fact is that it is there. And that also has quite a policy implication. If you're trying to understand the Roman Catholic Church, for example, Americans are often puzzled as to why the Catholic Church seems so reactionary and why the Vatican seems so out of step with American Catholics. Well, American Catholics make up 6% of the church worldwide. The Vatican is speaking to the bulk of Catholics, the Catholics where the population is growing rapidly, and they're speaking to the 21st century, for better or worse.
So for all of the criticism that Americans tend to level at the Vatican, that it's too hierarchical, too patriarchal, too conservative, you're saying that those values actually do represent most Catholics in the world.
They probably represent the Catholicism of, say, Africa and Asia and much of Latin America. Just to take a particular individual as an example, one of the leading African Catholics is Francis Arinze, a cardinal from Nigeria, who many people have suggested as a candidate for the next pope. If an African became pope, I think many people in the West would celebrate. I think liberals, for instance, would be delighted to see a black pope, and they'd be delighted for about 10 minutes until he opened his mouth. And this is why Catholic conservatives are basically having regular prayers for an African pope, namely this African pope. It tends to be quite a conservative tradition. It's a no-nonsense tradition, and especially on issues which are dear to American liberals, above all things like homosexuality, women's role. So, as I say, this may explain why liberals are not terribly happy with many aspects of the new Christianity.
Now, the Catholic Church is still the single largest church in the world, right?
In fact, the Catholic Church is the largest religious institution in the world. There are more Catholics than Muslims.
But in some ways, I get the sense that the real rise in numbers of Christians around the world is Protestants, Pentecostals, for instance.
It's both. Catholics are doing very well. A lot of the mainstream churches, like Anglicans and Lutherans, are actually doing quite well, though in conservative guises. But certainly the fastest growing strand would be the Pentecostals. One of the most remarkable success stories in modern history. The Pentecostal movement basically began at the start of the 20th century. Today, one estimate says that there are 400 million. And one projection says that they should be hitting a billion by around, the 2040s, by which point there will be more Pentecostals than Hindus. It's interesting that when we had our reviews of the 20th century and we looked at the great movements of the century, we looked at fascists, we looked at communists, but how many of us looked at Pentecostals, a very, very successful movement worldwide?
What happens when Christianity does take root in a continent like Africa? Does it become Africanized? Does it blend into local traditions?
In order for a religion to flourish, certainly it has to take on the coloring of the local society. It has to become African in Africa. And the mission churches that acknowledged this succeeded, and those that didn't withered away. We're actually living through right now one of the great ages of, what shall I say, intercultural contact, fusion in the history of religion. It's happening right now. We're living through one of the great ages in which people are taking the Christian message and putting it into their own hymns, their own poems, their own liturgies. For me, I'm originally a historian. It's very interesting. I've sometimes read people saying, you know, wouldn't it be amazing to see what it was like to see when the, you know, the Roman Empire was converted to Christianity, or to visit the time of the Reformation? Well, guess what? Buy an air ticket.
What would be some examples of how Africans have turned Christianity into something that really fits their own history, their own traditions?
Jesus said, I am the true vine. Well, people have never seen vines, so they become fig trees. Jesus says, I am the true fig. That sounds like a botanical example, but actually it's a very rich example of bringing a culture on board, because a fig tree is associated with continuity with the ancestors. Fig trees are often planted in tombs in large parts of Africa. And so what you're doing is using Jesus as the idea of the continuity with the ancestors. Ancestors are extremely important in African culture, and one thing that many African churches are doing is trying to integrate the idea of ancestors into Christianity. We now have liturgies that talk, for instance, about God as the great ancestor. Jesus is the great ancestor. Through much of Africa, much of the appeal of Christianity is a religion of healing and exorcism and spiritual warfare.
And these are exactly the kinds of things that a lot of Western Christians are embarrassed about. I mean, they know it's in the Christian tradition, but we just assume not deal with that and not talk about that. But you're saying that's precisely the appeal in a place like Africa.
It's exactly the appeal. I think when most liberal Western Christians read the very, very extensive passages in the Gospels, where, for instance, Jesus is healing or casting out demons, we tend to nod and say, he had a fine understanding of psychosomatic illness. Well, the people who wrote the New Testament probably didn't think that. Sometimes, and this is a very controversial one, but let me give you an example. Many African peoples use different kinds of rituals involving blood, involving, for instance, the sacrifice of a sheep. A Roman Catholic archbishop in South Africa recently suggested that Christian services should incorporate a ritual like this, that they might be prepared to accept the idea of blood sacrifice, which is so extensively justified in the Old Testament, because the people are very comfortable with this. And this ignited all sorts of objections.
Does this raise the question at all of what it means to actually be a Christian if what we see in Africa is so different from what a lot of liberal Western Christians want? It does kind of raise the question, what does it mean to be a Christian?
But I think often the critics of these new kinds of Christianity are slightly missing the point. They're seeing this as, the technical word is syncretism, that is merging Christianity with older pagan ideas. And often that's not it. What people are doing is taking ideas from the New Testament in a much more direct and literal way that people in the West have done in a very long time. Just to take an example, in many of the Pentecostal churches, concepts like dreams, trances, and visions are taken very, very seriously. Well, where are they getting this nonsense from? Well, read the New Testament sometime. Christianity came to Europe because St. Paul had a dream. He had a vision in a dream. People in, say, an African church or an Asian church read that, and what message are they meant to get? Well, people are meant to get visions from God in dreams. If Western liberals don't get visions in dreams, then that's their problem.
Philip Jenkins is the author of the book The Next Christendom, The Coming of Age of Global Christianity. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
A-shoo-ba-doom, do-do-doom. A-shoo-ba-doom, do-do-doom. A-shoo-ba-doom, a-shoo-ba-doom, do-do-doom. Praise His holy name.
By 2005, teens will be the largest single demographic group in the United States. They already influence more than $153 billion of family spending each year. That's a lot of kids spending a lot of money. And everyone's after it. From glossy magazines to MTV, you name it, it's being marketed to teens. Even Jesus. Haley Morgan is the developer of Extreme for Jesus, a line of more than 30 books for teens that's grown into a $10 million a year brand. But Morgan told Ann Strangechamps her passion isn't for the bottom line.
Well, we're talking about an extreme faith, an extreme spirituality, and we use the word extreme not in that it's extreme right wing or anything like that, that it's a fearful type of faith, but that it's an extreme personal faith, not unlike extreme sports. When kids participate in extreme sports, which this generation is just ravenous for, it's because they're after that adrenaline rush. They're after how difficult it is. They know they're going to get bruised, beaten, torn down. They run the risk of dying in some of these sports. And that's part of the passion behind it, and that's what drives them. They're sick of safety. They're sick of white bread America that offers them no excitement. And faith should be just as extreme in that it provides just as much passion and drive for the person, that they have just as much hunger after God as they do hunger for their, you know, their snowboard.
For example, you have a book called, a program maybe, called Step Off. Will you tell me about that?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's actually an adventure guide. Step Off, The Hardest 30 Days of Your Life. It was written by a guy named Justin Lukadoo, who is used to be a youth probation officer, and now he just speaks in public schools. And he put this program together to drive kids, again, to that extreme faith. They were tired of the same old wah-wah Bible study that told them to love God and pray more. That means really nothing. So what we did in this was we drove them to actually do things. They actually have to get involved. Here's the risk. They have to go to school one day and sit with the kid that nobody wants to talk to and bring them into their lives and help make their lives better. They have to give away something that they love, because if they can't, that something owns them. So we're asking them to do some really emotionally risky things, and that's kind of what the whole 30 days is. They have to give up media for 21 days, no TV, no radio, and they find out how much media is affecting the way they're thinking and the way they're behaving. So it's a tough book to do. I had to do it, and it killed me.
It's interesting because I guess the picture we usually have of teenagers is that they're fairly resistant to doing things.
I know, a lot of
hard work.
It's not true. Parents especially tell us that. They say, my kid will never do that. He'll never do that. And then they take it home, they hand it to the kid, and they say, you probably don't want to do this, but this is the deal. And the kid flips over it. Finally, something that it's tough, something that's difficult. Because if you think about this generation, they were raised with TV as their babysitter. When they have their computers on, they have 15 different screens going at once while the music is playing and they're on the phone. They're multi-sensory. They're continually being fed information. And if we don't compete with that and give them just as much energy and passion, you lose them in any kind of endeavor, anything you're doing, not even just spirituality.
One part of your work that's really interesting is market research, and I've seen some of the market research you've done. You know, you've talked with both non-Christian and Christian teens about Christianity, and you've done a lot, am I right, where you go into malls and just, you know, start talking with teenagers?
Yeah, we go wherever we can. We go to malls and online at schools and all kinds of things to talk to them. Mainly what we're doing in the malls is showing them the product, because unfortunately, we do judge books by their covers. And the Christian press to date has done a pitiful job of making books look halfway like they'd be something you'd want to read. So
give me an example. What do you show them and what do they say?
Well, we'll usually go in with three or four pictures of covers. We'll have, you know, maybe one with a guy screaming with his tongue pierced and he's got purple hair or something, and, you know, the extreme Bible. And then we'll have another one that looks completely different, has a different type of kid on it, and we'll just walk up to him and say, can we get your opinion on this? Would you pick up one of these? Would you even be interested in something like this?
And then what do they say?
Yeah, that one's okay. You know, it's amazing. Most of them will say, yeah, that one's all right.
Which one?
Oh, you want to know from that section of which one would they pick?
Yeah.
Oh, heck. I think they actually didn't pick the guy with the tongue ring. A surprise. I liked the guy with the tongue ring. They picked one that just looked kind of Terminator 2-ish. It looked kind of futuristic is what they picked on that one. So it's product by product by product. We just try to make sure that everything appeals to that, you know, appetite.
So but this is traditional marketing. I mean, you're figuring out how to make Christianity cool. And doesn't this seem sort of problematic to you?
I don't know why it's problematic. I think that the God who created the universe, and if he put all this amazing stuff together, as I sit here and look out the window, these trees, the sky is pretty cool. Well, he's done a pretty good job of appealing to me and saying, well, you're kind of cool. I'd like to find out more about you. Then we came along, the Christian world here in the last, I don't know, 50 years, and said, well, we'll throw something together and hopefully it'll sell. That's completely irrational to somebody who believes that God expects the best from us. If God wants us to be the best and do the best, then our stuff should be far superior than to anything MTV's doing or Viacom, Disney, anybody's doing. We should be totally tapped in to the most creative, amazing work that anybody's ever seen. So no, I think it stands right in line with what we believe.
I thought Christianity was supposed to offer sort of, you know, an alternative to consumer capitalism and the whole world of consumption. And it sort of seems like you're lumping Jesus in with Nike and Old Navy and Pepsi.
Well, I would be the first to say that. If you've ever been to the Christian Booksellers Association convention, you're going to see Jesus everywhere. Jesus floor mats, Jesus mugs. And I agree. I think we've over-marketed him. But I'm talking about content that's going to change people's lives. Now, here's my option. I can just throw it out there and make it look, you know, paper bag over the cover. Who cares what the cover looks like? And put it on a shelf next to Twist magazine and say, go ahead, kids, pick which one you want. And they're going to pick Twist. And they're going to learn how to give oral sex to their boyfriend at age 14. And they're going to learn how to take contraceptives at age 14. And their lives are going to slowly degrade. And I, as a believer, can't allow that. As somebody who believes that there's another way, that there's a faith-based way that will change their lives and make their lives so much better. I would be completely remiss if I didn't do all I could to try and help better their lives.
How did you come to this yourself? I mean, to be marketing Extreme for Jesus and doing this kind of work.
Well, I used to work for Nike out in Oregon, and found my faith out there and started realizing I didn't feel like I was changing the world by selling tennis shoes. And interestingly enough, got a call from a company out here in Nashville called Thomas Nelson Publishing that does sell Bibles and books. And I thought, well, here's something bigger than shoes. And so I came out here and kind of brought what I learned at Nike to this 200-year-old company that really didn't know how to reach teenagers. And it's been a terrific ride.
Haley Morgan is the developer of Extreme for Jesus, a line of more than 30 books for teens that have sold over 1 million copies. Her own book, Extreme Encounters, is the line's bestseller. Morgan spoke with Ann Strange James. Still to come this hour, a church's haunted house in Texas that tries to scare the hell out of teens. Literally.
Come on, Jeremy, put the gun down.
Good job, Jeremy. Now it's time for your eternal trip to hell.
Ah! Oh, my God! Help me!
Ah! I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. What do you get when you mix a fire and brimstone sermon with a haunted house? Now, throw in a cast of thousands and more lighting effects than a rock show. Welcome to Hell House, a controversial project of the Trinity Assembly of God Church in Crawford, Texas. Documentary filmmaker George Ratliff took a crew to Hell House to find out what all the fuss is about.
Well, there's a Trinity Assembly of God Church outside of Dallas. That Assembly of God is basically a branch of the Pentecostal Church. And they invented this event that they do on Halloween called Hell House. And it's a haunted house, but the object is to scare kids into Christianity. So instead of ghouls and goblins, they have scenes of what they consider contemporary sin. So they have an abortion scene, they have an AIDS death scene, they have a school shooting scene. And in every scene, a kid dies and is dragged off to hell by a demon. And at the end, they, you know, basically say, if you don't want to burn in hell, go right to this room, and we have counselors waiting. And it's very effective. And wow. We did a documentary that's sort of like a putting on a Broadway production, but it's this church putting on the haunted house.
I want to talk about some of the specific things that they do, because it's pretty bland, frankly, when you say, well, they do an abortion scene and an AIDS scene and
a
shooting scene. What are these actually like? Tell me about the abortion scene, for instance. What do they do?
Well, you know, it's real blood and guts. First of all, they're really good at putting on a show, and they love it. It's their favorite time of the year. The kids really get into it, and it's mostly, this is a church that's also a high school, and it's a kindergarten through high school school, so it's a big school, and all the kids, they get to do this haunted house every year, and they don't get to go to dances or go to movies or anything, so this is a big time for them, and it's really fun. It's like camp. So they do these really gory scenes, like abortion girls, just, you know, lots of blood, and she's gotten a botched abortion, and she's rolled in to, you know, a big effect, and she dies, basically. And if she doesn't, you know, pray to God before she dies, she gets drug off to hell.
Doctor, I need you. We've got an emergency over here.
Yes, Carter, what do we have here?
Her name is Jan. She's 17 years old. She took the new abortion pill, RU486, 2 days ago. She's been bleeding ever since this morning, complains of severe abdominal cramps, and her blood pressure is 80 over 60.
Why won't the bleeding stop? Matt said this wouldn't be a big deal. Why can't this just be over?
It'll never be over, Jan.
Please, somebody help me.
It's too late, Jan. You're going to hell. You're mine.
God, help me.
Some of this is sort of shocking for someone who isn't accustomed to, for anyone who isn't accustomed to seeing it. It's really nasty.
Yeah, it's not at all... It's not at all sensitive. They really made headlines in 1999 because they actually recreated the Columbine massacre 6 months after the fact, and they did a good job. It was really frightening.
Did they literally recreate it?
They have one big scene that they sort of structure Hell House around, and that was their big opening scene where you saw the two kids modeled after the Columbine shooters planning it out and sort of making the decision. And then you went into a library scene where, you know, it's sort of a peaceful setting where a girl is talking about her relationship with God, and these two kids come barreling in with real shotguns and real handguns with full load blanks and just shoot the place to hell.
Jeremy, what are you doing?
Come on, Jeremy, put the gun down.
To eliminate the problem.
Jeremy.
Good job, Jeremy. Now it's time for your eternal trip to hell. Come on!
Oh my God!
It was really...
Wow.
I mean, it's frightening on two levels because they do it pretty well, and they have light effects and music effects, and it's all, you know, cheesy sort of high school play things, but it's also the belief system that's behind it and the people around you make it very frightening.
We can't save people. We don't have that part. Only the Holy Spirit has the ability to save people. We plant seeds. We water seeds. We're competing for lost souls. And we're going to win.
Now, the reason that they put up Hell House every year is to show people what they believe and to try to convert them. You said at the end there is a room you can go to speak to counselors who will tell you how you can make your life better after that. And did you find they made any effort to convert you?
Before going in, I laid some ground rules that we were off limits. Our spiritual lives were our own, whether we had one or not. And they, for the most part, respected that. They did corner our sound man at one point, but for the most part, they respected it and left us alone. I'm sure they wanted to, and they believed that we were going to be converted, but we didn't. I would say that their sole objective in doing this is to convert people. And they believe in that so fiercely that, and actually at the beginning of the movie, Tim Ferguson, the main youth leader, sort of states that if he doesn't make his best effort to convert you, then he possibly could be sent to hell. And so it's not only that they're called to do it, they have to do it or else is what they believe. And so that's why they put so much time and dedication into converting people. And that's the success and detriment of Christianity, is that it's sort of called to do that.
I want to thank you all for coming to Hell House 10. From this point on, there's no more masks, death monitors, or gunshots. But this is the most important part of the whole tour. If you were to die tonight, do you know where you will go? Or do you think that you know? Because if you think that you know, then you're taking a chance with your soul for eternity.
What's the theology of the scenes? I mean, in the Columbine scene, for instance, what's the devil saying?
It's kind of a very Jagdschick belief. It's fundamentalist Christianity that there are demons right now floating in the air, and there are angels floating in the air, and you're either listening to angels or you're listening to demons. They really sort of believe in this. There's a writer in the 80s named Frank Peretti who wrote a book called This Present Darkness that sort of visualized for the fundamentalist community this world, and they really believe that. They really see that. They think that there are demons floating around.
Let's talk about the rave scene, which was new this year, I think. It was, in fact, put on by a guy who had spent, he said, a lot of time at raves.
Yeah. Thad really enjoys raves. He loves playing the DJ. And they, you know, also the thing about all these scenes is that you have to wonder that they're portraying these worlds that they're really not that familiar with. And Thad, you know, talked a pretty big game about the rave culture. But when you asked him
what the name of the the drug was, he didn't know.
Yeah, that's the big joke, that no one knew the name of the date rape drug that they were making the scene about, and they never figured it out.
One of the sort of sad things about that is that this young girl who went to the rave ends up taking a drug, and she didn't know that she was taking it. She gets raped, and she ends up killing herself and going to hell.
Right.
The victim is punished for eternity in their world.
Welcome home, Jessica. Did you have fun tonight?
I'm all alone. Oh, God, what am I going to do?
Poor Jessica. You could go to the police and tell them that you were raped. But then again, you don't know how many guys had you tonight, and you don't remember one of them. Do it, Jessica.
I want to die.
Do it, Jessica.
I want to die.
Do it now, Jessica. There, Jessica. Now isn't that better? Goodbye, Jessica. We'll see you in hell.
At the end, when the demons are going after her and she commits suicide, it's because nothing has gone right for her in her entire life. And as a result, she goes to hell.
I'm certainly not going to argue for the church. They get plenty of, rightfully so, ticked off people about their belief systems. And especially this scene in the AIDS death scene and, well, all of their scenes. But, you know, they justify it with she was rejecting God, and that's why she went to hell. But they certainly believe she should go to hell. That's their belief.
I truly believe that the end times are right upon us, and they're happening right now.
With rape, with suicide, with abortion, with homosexuality, with school shooting, with all these things.
The world is the worst that it has ever been. It's an ugly, evil world, and that's a scary thing, but at the same time, it's a good thing because that means that Jesus is close to coming and he's about to come back for his bride.
George Ratliff is the director of the documentary film Hell House. Coming up next, speaking in tongues.
I felt, you know, a burning on the inside of my stomach, and it just started, you know, coming up through my stomach, and then it started coming out of my mouth, and I was filled with the Spirit, and I'm still filled with the Spirit to this day.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're listening to a woman at a small Pentecostal church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, speaking in tongues. The phenomenon of speaking in tongues is such an intense religious experience that it's divided churches and started new religions. Theologian Harvey Cox says speaking in tongues is the most divisive and misunderstood theology of the Christian church. Cox told Ann Strangchamps that speaking in tongues is a way to worship.
Well, it's a form of prayer. Technically, we call it ecstatic utterance because you find it in a lot of different religious traditions, not just in Christianity, in which there is a verbal articulation, but it doesn't come out as actual words of that language or the language the person speaks. So it sounds to some people like gibberish, but to those who study it, it has a certain kind of structure and symmetry, but doesn't correspond to any particular language.
I was wondering how it struck you the first time you heard, you know, you were in a service and heard somebody speaking in tongues.
Well, the first time, of course, I was amazed and puzzled, bewildered by what was going on. But when I saw the people and listened to them who were speaking in tongues, most of them seemed to be joyous. That is, they didn't seem to be in anguish or pain. It seemed to be fundamentally a very positive expression. Later on, I read a study, actually a study done in the Lutheran church of people who speak in tongues in Lutheran churches. You know, that does go on in some Lutheran churches. And they found that by and large, the people who speak in tongues are better adjusted, happier in their lives than the normal run of people. And when I thought about that, it occurred to me that this really might be a way of expressing very, very deep feelings that are hard to get out in any other way and might indeed in that way contribute to a certain kind of mental health. So I went from being bewildered and puzzled to more being inquisitive. I have to admit right away, I have never spoken in tongues. That is not something I've experienced myself. So it's all been just observation and description.
I had no idea that Lutherans spoke in tongues. I guess when I think of Lutherans, I think of Garrison Keillor. That seems like a world very far away from speaking in tongues.
That's true. But the interesting thing about tongue speaking, it has spread at first from the Pentecostals into some Episcopal churches and then into Methodist and some Lutheran churches. And the Lutherans, as you might imagine, were concerned about what was going on here. This wasn't really kind of typical Lutheran behavior. So they appointed a study group consisting of a psychiatrist and a physician and a theologian and a historian. And they did a very thorough study, which they published about 10 years ago. And really, in effect, said, look, don't worry about this. The theologian in the group did include a section in the report in which he reminded readers that, in fact, people seem to be speaking in tongues in the early Christian church. You can see that in the letters of Paul the Apostle and in the Acts of the Apostles. St. Paul writes about this when he writes to the Corinthians, the famous passage, though I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, you know, and have not love, that one that's always read at mm-hmm. weddings. It's in the middle of a passage that he's writing to this little congregation in Corinth where people are speaking in tongues. There's no doubt about that among the New Testament scholars. St. Paul even says, I speak in tongues more than all of you. But then he goes on to say, let's keep this in order. It's better to speak a word that people can understand, but he doesn't ban it.
Does anybody have any idea why it appeared in the first place in the early church, what it might have meant at that time?
All we have is, of course, what they say, how they explained it. And they explained it in two ways, basically. One was that this was the way in which God was breaking down the destructive barriers between different people. The classic passage here is in the second chapter of Acts of the Apostles, which describes the Pentecost, when the tongues of flame come down and so on. And everybody is speaking, although speaking in their own language, they're understanding the languages that other people are speaking. That's a slight variant on the idea of speaking in tongues. But the interpretation for that is that this is a kind of reversal by God's grace of the Tower of Babel, where the the curse of different languages was enforced because of the pride the human race in trying to reach heaven on their own and all that. St. Paul has another kind of explanation in the Epistle to the Romans, where he says, when we can't pray, the Spirit intervenes and prays for us with groanings that cannot be uttered. That's the wording of the King James Bible. It's spoken differently it's translated differently, but it seems to be with sounds that are not linguistic.
So in that case, it sounds like the practitioner is sort of channeling the Holy Spirit.
Or you might say that the Holy Spirit is speaking through the person and enabling the person to pray. I rather favor that particular interpretation. One of the things I've noticed, and others, people who've studied this, is that speaking in tongues is often the practice of people who are not as articulate, who haven't been taught to speak in public, for example. When I visit Pentecostal churches in Latin America, and very poor people, women, let's say, who really have not learned how to stand up and give a speech or a testimony or something like that, they feel something very, very, very deeply, but they just don't have the words for it, and out flows this river of sounds, which can be very, very full of feeling, both joyful feeling and other kinds of feeling, but they're not in any particular language.
Some speaking in tongues I've heard sounds like that. It's part singing, it's vocalizing, you can hear joy in it, you can hear other people laughing.
Right.
But some I've heard sounds almost like a foreign language, like some kind of ancient language. What's going on there?
Well, yes, there are some people who claim that what is being spoken is an ancient language. Sometimes they even say an ancient and forgotten language, which makes it pretty hard to check up on. I have never myself witnessed anybody speaking in tongues who was actually speaking a language that that person had not learned or didn't know. There was a time in early Pentecostal history, I should mention, when they believed, this was back in the early years of the 20th century, movement started around 1905 in Los Angeles, and they thought that the end of the age was coming, and they were being commissioned to go out to the ends of the earth and proclaim the gospel before the second coming of Jesus Christ, and that therefore God was equipping them with the languages through which they could speak to Africans or Chinese or Australian Aborigines or whatever. They fully believed that's what was happening. They didn't understand the languages, but they thought that the people that they were going to preach to would understand them. They had a big disappointment when they got there. People did not understand them. And therefore, they had to find a new interpretation for speaking in tongues. Now, that to me is enormously fascinating, that the expression itself, that is the phenomenon of speaking in tongues, continues even though the explanations change from age to age.
Harvey Cox is a professor of divinity at Harvard University and a prolific and much acclaimed author on Christian theology. He spoke with Anne Strange Chance. Christian music is the only musical genre that actually increased sales last year. This year, Christian music will sell over 50 million albums. What's given rise to such success? Christian rock. Ask any Christian rock musician today who opened the doors for them, and they'll all give you the same answer. Stryper. Stryper was a Christian heavy metal band during the 1980s. They were huge, and not just in Christian circles. Stryper sold millions of records and played sold-out shows around the world. They were even the first band to ever have three songs on the MTV Top 10 Countdown at the same time. Oz Fox was Stryper's lead guitar player and backup singer. He told Anne Strange Champs that many Christians had problems, with the idea of a Christian heavy metal band.
Especially in the appearance end of it. I mean, when you're wearing spandex pants, you don't really look too Christian. You know, we teased our hair up really high.
Heavy makeup.
Yeah, the music was loud. We were kind of on the verge of glam as well. At the time, that was a popular thing with the rock scene as well. It just turned into this thing where we felt we wanted to play this kind of music. I guess it was just a passion for the music. And what we believed in was important to us as well. We wanted to blend that in. And we didn't know what was going to happen. We knew that there was probably going to be a lot of people that would think, oh, this is crazy. And we did. We got scoffed a lot. But for the most part, there were a lot of young people out there who really were into heavy metal, but their parents wouldn't let them listen to it because they were Christians or they didn't like the way it sounded or the way these guys looked or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And we brought an alternative to these young people who wanted that kind of a genre of music. And as soon as they showed it to their parents, you know, obviously their first reactions were, oh, this can't be true. But then as time went on, we became their band. And it just exploded on the scene.
I want to play an example of the kind of music Stryper played and what you're talking about. This is More Than a Man off of your To Hell with the Devil album.
Great song. Great song, yes. Words are really meaningful.
So the lyrics go, you know, God, I will follow you because you died for me, gave to me your life to set me free. Anyone who asks shall receive Jesus in your heart. It's time for you to start giving God all the glory. So is Stryper more about preaching, do you think, or more about the rock and roll?
Well, I believe it all goes hand in hand. If music can be used as a way to bridge the gap, to send a message to a young person who likes the music, but may not necessarily know the message, if they hear the word in the music, they're going to respond. And that's exactly what happened to a lot of these young people. They responded to, well, first they liked the music, but then they responded to the words. Then they looked deeper into the whole situation and saw what we were, and it changed their lives.
Do you think some teenagers who listened maybe wound up being converted?
No, definitely. It's proven. I've got there's many, many people who have met me in person or have emailed me or sent letters that have told me that Stryper and the ministry of Stryper has changed their lives. And some of them have gone on to be pastors, youth pastors, missionaries, the whole thing. It's amazing, and it's humbling. I never expected that to happen.
When Stryper hit the mainstream music scene, you guys really exploded. I mean, you had top 40 hits, number one videos on MTV. I think at one point Stryper had 3 videos in MTV's top 10 countdown. That would be amazing for any band, but even more so for Christian music. I wanted to play one of your number one MTV hits. This is the rock ballad, Honestly, which a lot of people might remember. Did it ever surprise you, the success of a song like Honestly, you know, which beat out the likes of Madonna, U2, or Bruce Springsteen for a number one MTV spot?
To me, it was just, it was awesome, and it was neat to be able to see people liked our music, and that we were touching lives, and that it went to number one was exciting. But, you know, ultimately you feel, wow, that's something's happening and something's working with what you're doing. And it seemed like this was working. This was reaching people, and people were being touched by it, and that made me feel good.
In the meantime, the rest of the heavy metal scene, a lot of it, was the satanic side. And this was a time when Motley Crue had a hit song and a video called Shout at the Devil, which was basically a song in praise of evil. And Stryper then came out with this song, To Hell with the Devil, which was a big hit. Maybe we could play some of that.
Okay. Definitely some flapping going on in that throat.
Was this kind of song a reaction to what was happening in the music scene around you?
Oh, definitely. We knew what was going on out there. We felt strong feelings against what was happening with rock music. Not that we didn't like rock music. It was just some of the stuff that was out there that was blatantly in-your-face satanic was really irking us. That was our reaction to it, was to come up with a song that would be totally opposite to that. And well done, I think, you know. It gets the point across. And actually, that song became one of the anthems for our group, was, you know, let's get rid of the devil and let's become soldiers under command. Let's believe in Jesus. That's really what it was all about.
Oz Fox was in the Christian heavy metal band Stryper. He spoke with N Street Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Fire and Brimstone, program number 112A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Sinatra swings it. Miles Davis jazzes it up. Billie Holiday croons it from the heart. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the biography of a great American love song. In our Valentine's Day show, the Rodgers and Hart hit My Funny Valentine. And our listeners share true stories of love at first sight. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.